Hello, everyone. I'm Barbara Eady from BarbaraEady.com, and today I'm speaking with Cynthia Kersey. Cynthia is the best-selling author of two books, Unstoppable and Unstoppable Women, and she's a speaker, entrepreneur, national columnist, team coach, and chief humanitarian officer of her nonprofit foundation, whose focus is to ensure that every child on the planet has access to the lifelong gift of education. Cynthia knows firsthand that giving is not only good for business, it's good for the soul. In her powerful program, Unstoppable Giving, Cynthia not only inspires individuals to give, but she provides entrepreneurs with a practical action plan on how they can increase their bottom line, expand their business, create customer evangelists, and become completely invigorated about their life, business, and by integrating generosity as a business philosophy. Cynthia embodies her message and has integrated giving and contribution into her life and business for well over a decade. Her foundation has helped to fund over 40 schools in three countries and bring education to over 5,000 children a day and bring clean water, sanitation, health care, and training to over 15,000 community members. Wow, thanks, Cynthia. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for having me.
that's an incredible bio, and it sounds like you've been on an incredible journey. So,
yes.
To begin with, can you just tell us about your own journey of how you went from being a successful career woman in corporate America and then choosing to establish mm-hmm. the Unstoppable Foundation and become a philanthropist?
Well, that's kind of a long journey from being in corporate America to where I am today. And it started by a desire to be doing something that was meaningful and on purpose. So I was at Sprint Communications for over 10 years and literally started as a telemarketer, worked my way up to a national account manager. I sold the Kinko's account, which was a multi-million-dollar account for Sprint, and, you know, made it to the top of my career. And again, I wasn't passionate about what I was doing. So through a process of self-reflection, I realized that what really inspired me was when I was encouraging other people. And as I looked at what had provided me the most encouragement throughout my life, it was stories of people who were unstoppable, you know, people who had this dream or vision or goal, and despite everything working against them, they had the courage to say, this is important, and I'm not going to let anything stop me. And so I loved those kinds of stories, and literally back in 1996, downsized my life, cashed in my entire life savings to write my first book, Unstoppable. So, you know, I'm living on purpose, and a year and a half after my book came out, I had been married 20 years, and my husband and I got a divorce. And that was the beginning, that turning point of transition of really looking again at, you know, of where I was in my life. And what had happened was I called my mentor, Millard Fuller, who was the founder of Habitat for Humanity, and told him, you know, I had separated from my husband and I was really devastated. And he said, when you have a great pain in your life, you need a greater purpose. And even though I was living my purpose, you know, I quit my job. I put everything on the line to write this book, but it wasn't bigger than my pain. And he suggested that maybe I build a house with Habitat for Humanity. And he had just gotten back from Nepal and told me about how beautiful it is and how beautiful the people are and yet how impoverished they are there. So as I thought about it, I thought, you know, how many houses would I need to build that would be bigger than this pain in my life? And nothing even kind of really inspired me until I got to the number 100, which seems kind of crazy because at the time, you know, it was $2,000 to build a house, so it's 200 grand. I'd never raised any money in my life. I'd never been to Nepal. I didn't have a big community. I didn't have a lot of, you know, resources or, you know, all I had was, wow, this feels inspiring to me. And decided, okay, this is what I was going to do. So that year of really healing and grieving, I would think about families, you know, who didn't even have a simple, decent place to live. And that inspired me to get over myself and continue to move forward. And that year while I was out there speaking, we raised $200,000. I took a group of 18 people to Nepal, and the next holiday season we worked on the first three of the 100 homes that were subsequently built. That experience, you know, we always have these kind of pivotal moments. That experience was the impetus that allowed me to really experience the power of giving, the transformative power in my life. You know, I think so often, Barb, we think we're helping somebody else and we feel very noble about that. And, gee, aren't we a big magnanimous person? And, you know, what we get is, once we do it, is what we get out of it. It's, you know, it almost feels like it pales in comparison, but I think that's the beauty of giving, is that the receiver, the giver, the gift to the giver is as great, if not more, than the gift to the receiver. So I had done a lot of philanthropic projects throughout my business. And in 2008, I was invited to go to a conference in rural Africa. I knew one person who was going. She told me about it, and just inside I thought, I need to do this, even though it wasn't convenient. You know, I had to reschedule my plans. I had to book a trip last minute to Nairobi, flew over there, was met with 40 women from North America, got on a bus, and for 2 days, with no transmission and, you know, no air conditioning, and, driving out to the middle of nowhere, what it felt like. And I was just aware of myself and kind of what was going on. And I thought, God, please help me get over my little self so that when we get there, I don't miss why I'm here. And, you know, it's funny as I say this, because that going to that trip was again a turning point for me doing what I'm doing now. And I got there, and we were greeted by 400 women from the heart of Kenya, you know, in this rural communities, who walked many times days to be with us and to really share their stories and looking for solutions, not asking for a handout, but a solution. And I fell in love with them, and I promised that I would do something. And the number one thing they wanted was, how do we get our kids an education? Because they knew without it, there was no hope of stopping the cycle of poverty. And I came home, and I was at my friend's house, Debbie Ford, and her son for his bar mitzvah. Instead of asking, you know, getting gifts, he asked for people to donate to build a school. And as she was talking about that school, I literally sat up on the couch, and I thought, that's what I want to do for my birthday. And I had a big birthday that was coming up, my 50th birthday, that, by the way, I was not that happy about turning 50 and not that excited about the birthday.
Okay.
And, you know,
but it sounds like things changed.
Yeah, but I was excited about having a fundraiser, a birthday party that would make a difference. Mm-hmm. And I charged people $100. I wasn't a big event person, hadn't done that before, again, didn't know how to do it. I think I hired somebody to help me for like $1,000. And we put this party together, and we raised $80,000 that night. And Marcy was there, as a matter of fact, and, you know, Bob Proctor and Mary Morrissey, just so many, you know, Mark Victor Hansen, so many great friends. And that, again, was one of the single most joyful days of my life, bar none. And I thought, wow, if I could do that in one night, what could I do if I actually focused on it, you know, if I put a little energy into it? So while that was in 2008, and we've just had our fifth annual gala.
Okay.
And, you know, since then, 2 years ago, was another turning point when I really just felt like I couldn't do my business anymore. I couldn't sell another coaching program. I couldn't do another email blast. It was like I was done. And I decided to do my, I've been wanting to do this full time for a long time and just didn't know exactly how I was going to do it. I talked to two friends, Mary Morrissey and Marcia Reeder both, and we just came up with a strategy of you call three people a day and ask them. I'd had a campaign idea that I wanted to do. It was called Give a Little, Get a Lot. Mm-hmm. So I called three people a day and asked them to either donate product or money. And that was, you know, once I was fully in, and I'd been wanting to do this for many years, fully 100% of the time, but mm-hmm. once I decided, it's kind of like that, you know, that quote is, you know, until one is committed,
right.
you know, once one is committed, right, it's like everything lines up to support you, and that's really what happened. And I got, you know, people donated money, and Nick and Alex Ortner, not only did they donate $50,000, but they asked if they, you know, offered to do the entire campaign for free. I mean, it was just really beautiful. And now I'm doing this full time, and I'm very inspired by what I'm doing. And, you know, I think, wow, what a way to live for me that, you know, my life gets to be about inspiring people to give, because that's the greatest blessing that
right.
anybody can experience. And number two, it gets to be about making sure that children get a chance. They, you know, in through education and the model that we do, and we'll talk about in a little bit, but it not only supports the children, it uplifts the entire community. So
right.
that was a long answer to that story, but
that's okay. So when you say doing this full time, Cynthia, are you talking about the Unstoppable Foundation
yes,
or
right,
the Unstoppable
right, that's
Giving
right.
Program?
That's
okay.
right. Yeah,
right.
exactly.
Right, because I know you.
That's right.
Right, because I know you started a new program that we're going to talk a little bit about as well. But back to what you said mm-hmm. about, you know, being so inspired mm-hmm. and realizing that it's not just about your little self, but doing something
yeah.
that's bigger than you and how you feel when you're with these African women.
Yeah.
And these children,
mm-hmm.
I know I heard you say on another interview that when you're talking about your work in Africa, when you educate a child,
yeah.
especially a girl, it can
mm-hmm.
save her life. Can you
mm-hmm.
just speak to that a little?
Well, you know, it's interesting. So when girls, even in the communities we're working in right now, we're in 10 communities in 3 countries in Africa. And let me just address why Africa right now. Our
mm-hmm.
vision, my vision is that every child gets access to an education. Every child gets access to a quality education. And currently, the number was 72 million. It's actually now, the latest number is 57 million. So it's actually going down. We're making some headway. But there are 57 million children who don't even have access to a primary education. And so when and 43% of those children, almost half of them, live in the sub-Saharan Africa. So it's kind of like triage is the way I kind of look at it. You look at where
right.
is the need the greatest, because in these communities, not only do they not have access to school, they don't have clean water. And without having access to clean water, the girls are fetching contaminated water 3-4 times a day, the moms and the girls.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they don't have basic health services. I mean, when you go there, there are no basic health services, period. You know, when you go into labor, if your child gets malaria, I mean, you know, there's the Gates Foundation did a video called Inpatient.
Mm-hmm.
And it showed, you know, a mother whose little girl got malaria. And they were documenting her and her mother walking with this little girl. By the time she made it to a vehicle, the little girl was close to death and actually died on the way to the health clinic. And the wailing and the sound of her grief, you know, for less than a cup of coffee,
mm-hmm.
that girl's life would have been saved. So we, you know, I think a lot of people don't really understand that. If they've not been there, they don't really get, they'll say, well, you know, we have challenges in the United States, which we absolutely do.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, you have to stay true to what your calling is. And we mm-hmm. are, you know, we're really looking at those children and those communities who don't have those basic services. And if we take care of this generation, they can take care of the next. And when you educate a girl in the communities that we support, first off, right now, girls are married off by the age of about 12 years old. Now, why is that? The reason the parents marry them off isn't because they don't love their daughters. It's because what kind of a future does their girl have if what's she going to do? She doesn't get an advanced degree. She doesn't even get education. And basically, the boys are the ones that they'll keep in school. And then the girls will marry off. They'll marry them off to a man that they hope can help her, take care of her. And the reality is it continues to perpetuate the cycle of poverty. So many times these girls are marrying men 4 and 5 times their age. Yeah. So number one, when you marry later, because when little girls that are 12 years old have babies at 12 years, because that's what happened when you get married, right? You start having mm-hmm. sex, you get pregnant. Mm-hmm. And these girls are too young to bear children. So right. there's that piece. There's the piece also when you educate a mom, a mother puts 75% back of what she earns back into the family. And to educate her children and keep them alive. The father does, on average, about 25%. So when you educate a girl, she grows up to be able to take care of her own daughter. You know, we're seeing it in our communities now, so many of them. And they even still, in the communities we're working in, they practice female circumcision. That's a nice way of saying, you know, other ways of saying it is female genital mutilation.
Right.
So they don't have the rights that, and again, that is a practice that is based on the marriageability of a child. They are not doing this to inflict pain, although it does, of course. Mm-hmm. But it's, again, it's a whole socialization of if a girl isn't circumcised, you know, no man will want to marry her. You know, she won't, you know, all that. So, you know, education helps change that, and that all of that requires education. Right. From, you know, and again, it can't come from the you know, the white people in America. It really has to be a partnership in which the leaders and the elders in these communities really right. see and commit to educating their girls and their children and ensuring they're in school. And then, as a matter of fact, one of the communities that we're working in, we were fortunate to be able to fund the very first secondary school. Think about this. We're in 28 schools, or we were at that point in this particular area. Out of 28 schools, primary schools, only 40 girls were chosen to go to that first school because that's all the room they had. They had room for 40 beds. You know, it was a boarding school because these came from, you know, rural communities where, you know, it could take days to walk to school. So it's a boarding school. 40 beds, 40 desks, 40 books, 40 pencils, everything, right? Mm-hmm. And Susan, all these people applied for it. Susan was the 41st girl. Mm-hmm. So you can imagine the devastation of her finding out that she didn't make the list. Mm-hmm. And she walked to school on the first day of school, and the principal saw her and said, "Susan, you know, what are you doing here?" And she said, I know that, you know, I got the news, but I had to see for myself." And she's mm-hmm. crying talking to the principal. And the girls heard her, and they came together, and they got in a huddle, and they started talking. And about 10 or 15 minutes into Susan's conversation with the principal, they stopped and they interrupted the principal and said, "Please, let her stay in school. We'll move our beds together so that we can fit a bed for her. We'll share with her. We'll move our desks together so that we can make room for her. I'll share my books." Each one of them was kind of saying what they would do to help because they knew firsthand that if she went home, what hope she had.
Right.
And that day, Susan became the 41st girl.
Oh, beautiful.
At that school. And there are millions and millions of Susans out there,
mm-hmm.
you know, who work hard, who want to be able to go to school, who beg their parents to go to school, but there's no school there, there's no adequate teachers, it just isn't there.
Right.
And that's what I'm committed to. I'm committed to all of the Susans out there, and
right.
you know, who want to go to school, they just are looking for a chance.
Mm-hmm. And as you said, not just education, but these communities need so much more. Like
yeah,
they don't
exactly.
have health care.
That's
you know,
right.
They don't have clean water.
That's right.
So on that note, that's mm-hmm. part of what your foundation is doing as well now, putting
yeah.
into place that kind of model that's really about sustainability. And,
that's right.
And looking after the entire community.
Yes, from a holistic perspective, because as great as it is, and there's so many beautiful organizations out there that do great work, and maybe they just deliver water, and water is critical. But if you only deliver water, you're still not dealing with the basic opportunity to help people lift themselves out of poverty. Or if you just worked with education, and you didn't mm-hmm. give them the clean water, the kids would be sick. The girls would be right. fetching water. Do you see what I'm saying? It's a holistic
right.
approach. It's not like we said, okay, one day we should do five pillars. It really came as a result of seeing different models out there and what actually works. You know, then you could have clean water, but if the children's health needs aren't taken care of, they're sick and they're not going to come to school.
Right.
And many kids, the only nutritious meal that they get is the one that they get at school. So that's a great, not only in a way to help them be, you know, strong and be able to focus during the day, but it's an incentive for parents to send their kids to school. And then the final piece, which is critical, is the ability for parents to generate an income so it's self-sustaining. It's not a hand out. It's a hand up. And after 5 years, once all of these five pillars have been implemented, it then moves into a thing that the community is able to sustain on their own.
Right. So that makes, in a way, you're building unstoppable communities.
Yeah, that's exactly what we're doing. That is exactly,
really,
and on a very
fundamental basis. It's a whole new program
basis.
For you.
Huh?
Well, it's already part, it's a whole new program for you.
It is, and it's exciting. Talk about transformation.
Absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely. Well, you've given us some insight into, yeah, building unstoppable communities.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think makes a person unstoppable? Mm-hmm. For people who want to make a difference in the world, some of the people that you've interviewed, Cynthia, and you said have inspired you so much,
mm-hmm.
what are some of the key qualities
yeah.
or what do you think really makes someone unstoppable?
Well, at a very fundamental level, it's a person who has a dream, a goal, a vision, a purpose, and doesn't let their circumstances, people, their environment, or more importantly, themselves, stop them from really taking a stand. You know, it's so funny because it's not really funny, but, you know, it's not always easy, you know, doing this. I don't always feel comfortable asking people for money or at each level of how I'm putting myself out there. I'm always uncomfortable. You know, if you're growing and you're doing these, you're always going to be uncomfortable. I mean, at every level and, you know, really standing in this vision of seeing education for every child. And I have my own self-doubt when I really, you know, when I listen to the smaller voice that argues for our limitations.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but on the other hand, it's like there's a much bigger voice that says, if not me, then who? And I've seen these children, and so what really gives me the strength to move forward is being their voice. It's interesting,
right.
2 years ago at the gala, the Unstoppable Gala, I completely lost my voice a day or two before the gala. I couldn't speak a word. And Mary Morrissey, who's a good friend of mine, she says, isn't it interesting that you're here being a voice for children who have no voice, and now you've lost your voice? And I started sobbing. And I thought, oh, that is so true. And I was able to actually speak my own little, you know, my smaller part. I you know, it wasn't very strong, but it was, I was able to speak. But that, you know, so to me, what inspires me and allows me to be unstoppable is just really staying connected to what I'm doing and why I'm doing it. And then getting out of my own little way, you know, my own, not really listening to the smaller self or the ego, but really allowing, you know, myself to really stay, you know, connected to my calling.
Connected to your calling and staying with it no matter what.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, we just have a couple of minutes. So I just wanted to wrap up by asking, lastly, I know you have a new program, Unstoppable Giving, and that talks about, and as we said in the intro, talks about the power and benefits of giving, both from a business perspective and personal perspective. What are some of those benefits? What are you finding with your ungivable giving?
Right. Well, I mean,
giving?
Oh, my goodness. Well, so there's so many studies. I mean, spiritual teachers have been talking about this for years, you know, for thousands of years, the power of giving. And now scientists and social scientists have done all sorts of studies about the power of giving. And unanimously, they say that giving is the most potent force on the planet. The most potent force on the planet. Giving makes you feel great. We all get that. It's good for your health. I mean, people who have illnesses that are caregivers actually live longer than the people receiving the giving, the services. They have doctors now that are writing prescriptions for people to give, as part of, you know, of supporting them with any number of ailments. You know, it's good for your pocketbook. I mean, if I had more time, you know, I could go into this. I mean, now they've got, you know, billion-dollar organizations are now aligning with social purpose and social causes. Why is that? Well, at a basic level, they get it's good for them. You know, and people are really choosing with their wallets what kind of organizations that they want to support and or buy services or products from. So there's all sorts of ways of giving. And, you know, like I said, if we had more time, we could go into the details. But I think the takeaway is that giving, when people really connect to it, they know. When, you know, there is no greater joy. There is no greater experience than when you, what is it, the Booker T. Washington that said, you know, there's nothing greater than when you, you know, reach down and help someone, when you can help someone else. And it's so true. Or you can't help someone else by not helping yourself.
Yourself, right. And when you give to others, you give to
yourself. And one way I would love to share is we've created a really simple way for people to, like I did my birthday, right? I used my birthday to educate, really to bring education, and we have this new program called A Right to Learn, and that's R-A-G-H-T, tolearn.org. And we're just now relaunching it with like the 2.0 version, but A Right to Learn.org. And it allows people an opportunity. There are people listening to this and might say, oh, I want to be able to, I'd like to give up my birthday. I'd like to, for my, you know, son's bar mitzvah, you know, let him raise money, or I'd like for our anniversary. We have a whole platform that we've created that enables people to share it with their friends and their family and allows them to donate money. And then what we do is when the campaign's done, we bundle it all together and it goes towards sponsoring a village at a time, which what we've talked about, those five pillars. It's $25,000 to sponsor one village. So it's a really fun, exciting, easy way that you can, as a family, as an individual, as an organization, as a group, do something that will outlive yourself and, you know, completely transform a community for generations to come.
Fabulous. And as you said, experience the power of giving.
That's right.
It'll be as good for you. It'll be as good for you as those you're giving to.
Oh, my goodness. People, when I did this for my birthday, they all came to me and said, thank you so much for giving us an opportunity to give. I mean, quite frankly, I didn't need another birthday present. I didn't need another. There was nothing that I needed.
Right.
And this is something that you can't buy. The power of giving is something that you cannot buy, the experience of that.
No,
you only get it.
Absolutely not. And again, the website, Cynthia, just to close, because I know you've got to go, was
yes.
the righttolearn.org.
A right to learn.org. And then you can also learn about that on the, it's called unstoppablefoundation.org.
Great. Thank you so much for your time.
You're
welcome.
We've been
talking to Cynthia Kersey. Thank you, the mm-hmm. queen of giving. Thank you for being such a good example, Cynthia.
Thank you, Barb. I really appreciate the great work you're doing and appreciate your including me. So.
Okay, great. You take care.
Uh-huh.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.